One way of getting more finance as a property investor is to get a higher valuation on your properties. So how do you go about this? How does a valuer evaluate your property? What do they like to see? What adds value? And what makes them nervous? These are some of the questions I'm going to be asking my guest today, Belinda Botsolis, a valuer with one of the leading national firms of valuers. But as you'll find out, Belinda's far from a conventional valuer. And even if you're not about to get a valuation or a re-evaluation, I'm sure you're going to find the property tips Belinda has to offer of real value. And there's a little bombshell Belinda will be leaving us with at the end of our chat. But you're going to have to wait till the end to hear that. I'm also going to share my popular mindset message with you. So welcome to today's show.
Welcome to the Michael Yardney Podcast, where twice each week you will learn a number of new ideas regarding success, property investment, and money in around 30 minutes. Our show is brought to you by Metropole, who specialize in helping you grow, protect, and pass on your wealth through strategic property and wealth advice. Now, here's your host, Michael Yardney, Australia's authority in wealth creation through property, who has been voted one of Australia's top 50 most influential thought leaders.
You've often heard me say that property investment's a game of finance with some houses thrown in the middle. But how much finance you get is dependent upon the valuations of your property. So today I'm going to chat with Belinda Botsolis, a valuer, to get a sneak peek behind the curtains of what they do, how they value a property, and what you can do to improve your valuations. Hi, Belinda.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Well, Belinda, while many people would think valuers must be boring because they deal with numbers and figures all day, you're far from boring. In fact, many people would say you're an influencer. You've got a significant following on TikTok and on Instagram. And it's not because you're good at dancing. It's because you give great property advice on social media.
I guess I started my social media about 6 months ago.
Is that all?
Yep, about 6 months. I had my Instagram account a little bit longer, but it was sort of more of a private personal page. And then I expanded it to give a little bit more, you know, professional property advice. And within a span of 6 months, I think I've got a bit over 75,000 on TikTok. And no, I don't dance. But I do like to play around with, you know, different trends and, you know, giving advice in a way that I think everybody can relate to. And I think that's resonated with a lot of people. So,
and you make it fun. Which
I do.
Is good.
Yeah, which I try. I try.
Now, Belinda, we're going to talk a bit about how to get the best valuation, what valuers look for, what you shouldn't do and what you should do. So I know that our listeners are going to get great value. But beforehand, it's probably worth understanding why they should listen to you, who you are, where you've come from. So do you mind if we just go back a couple of steps to the beginning of your journey?
So I guess the last year of high school, Michael, I had the choice of, you know, what uni I wanted to go to, what I wanted to study. This is a true story. I sort of opened.
I hope so.
It was. I opened up the university guide book and it fell onto a page and I saw, you know, Bachelor of Business Property Economics. I thought, gee, isn't that interesting? I'd love to do something in property. I had a family friend that was a valuer, spoke to them about it, and I just knew that was my calling, got the results I needed it for my year 12 marks, and the rest is history. It's a Bachelor of Business majoring in property economics. You have to study that for 3 years. Then you work as a bit of a grad valuer and was a mortgage valuer straight off the bat.
And you've worked with a couple of very big national companies and you are now an associate director of one of the big national companies. But how did you first personally get into your own property, your first property?
I bought my first property at 22. He, now husband, was my boyfriend, I guess, you know, the very early days. And we bought an investment property that we wanted to eventually live in. So our journey into the property market was not one of a traditional investor where you look at a property through the eyes of an investor. It was through the eyes of a homeowner and it was a unit. So we thought, let's see if it can tick both boxes of satisfying a bit of an investment need that we needed, but also being a home at, you know, it was a unit down the track. And we did that by finding something extremely original, 1960s gem of a property, really good bones. And we thought, great, this is one that we can add some equity in through renovation. And that was our first, I guess, purchase, investment, renovation, home, little nest egg that launched us into several other property purchases. The first one's always the special one.
It is. How hard was it for you to get into the property market? Because people say it's hard today, and it is, but hasn't it always been hard?
It was hard. I think for us, we could have borrowed a lot more and extended ourselves a lot more, but we were very sensible in not taking it that far because we knew that our first home was not our forever home and it was going to be the launch pad into our second home, potentially third, fourth home that we wanted to build our property portfolio by maybe leapfrogging one after the other. We knew that we wanted, you know, we were getting married, so we had some money there. I wanted a honeymoon, you know. And I had just started working and I knew eventually I would be earning more. So I knew I had a bit more room to move. And that was the reason we didn't extend ourselves and we just bought within our means, really, really within our means and not stretching. But saving and discipline, you need discipline when you're buying your first home. It's very easy to do those Kentucky tours with all your friends and new cars and you see them with all their fancy clothes because when you're at uni, Michael, and you're waiting on tables and you're earning, you know, a couple hundred dollars a week and then you get your first job as a professional, you think, wow, I'm rich all of a sudden, and it's very easy to blow through that money because you're very excited to all of a sudden have that big paycheck. But that discipline and
delayed gratification, isn't it?
Yes.
You do the hard things early in life so you have the easy life later on. So what advice would you give for somebody who's looking to get into the market now, Belinda, and they're hearing that property values have gone up 20% or more and the Reserve Bank may be putting up interest rates and they're a bit nervous, a bit scared. Is it too late? What would you say to them?
It will feel like it's never going to happen. It's going to feel like, oh, if only I had started 6 months ago, if only I had started earlier or saved harder. What I think, there's always a B suburb or a B market to your A suburb or that A grade property that you wanted to buy first up. What I mean by that is everybody wants their dream location and their dream home. Unfortunately, that may be slightly out of your reach now. Have a plan B, plan C, and plan D, and understand that, okay, I'm not quite at A's out of reach now, but what can I afford in my B suburb? And try and get, I always say, it's always better to not buy the most expensive house in the worst street, but potentially buying the worst house in the best street, in the best suburb. So
very old-fashioned advice, but it stood the test of time.
It has.
It?
You can add, you know, equity, you can renovate. When you have that goal, because location, you cannot, that's the fix. The variable is the property and the variable is the improvement that you can add equity to. But when you talk about the fixed, you can't fix a bad location. You can't fix a, you know, a highway or a, you know, located next to a shopping center that's a school drop-off zone. But a great suburban street will always be a great suburban street, you know, all things considered.
I like that advice.
Yeah.
Now, you've obviously done well as a property investor, but let's talk about your career as a valuer. What's the most common question people ask you when they find out you're a valuer, or are you embarrassed to tell them that?
No. Funny you say that, Michael. A little while back, I did a TikTok on this, and it was, if I had a dollar for every time somebody asked me this question, I'd have $546,023. And that question is, why do you undervalue property? Why do you undervalue property? Why do you, anywhere, barbecue, I'll go to, you know, check out at Coles and the lady behind, you know, what do you do for our value? Why are you undervaluing? That's a really big misconception that valuers deliberately undervalue. Yes, I can appreciate that we may be conservative to a degree in terms of valuing for a bank, and we have all legislation and regulations that we need to abide by. But yes, the most common question I get is, why do you always undervalue my property when you do it for the bank?
So why do you undervalue their property?
Well, we don't necessarily.
That's a question. I guess I didn't ask a good question because I asked you, you answered my question, but you didn't answer the question people ask you.
We don't. And then it's like, oh, how do I even start this? It's it's one of those things where you just like, oh, I should just get a card written up with the answer and just hand it out to people. It might be a bit easier than, you know, having to explain.
Well, maybe a better question I could ask, Belinda, is how do you value a property? How do you assess the value of a property?
Okay, I've used this example before, so if anybody's heard it, it might just be hearing it all over again. I'll give you this example, Michael. Where you live, you keep your finger on the pulse, I'm guessing. You check out the auction results and you know what's been selling. I bet you've seen some properties that you sort of said to yourself, gee, that was good buying. I thought that went a bit cheap. I probably would have paid a bit more if I was, you know, going to purchase that. Then you've seen another home and you've gone, how in the, you know, heavens has that home got an extra $600,000 more than that home down the road? I don't get it. Hot auction. Who knows? We get presented with comparable sales like that all the time. So if you have three different valuers assessing your property, we have to look at the property during the inspection without an emotional attachment. We walk through it. And that's why a lot of people say, why is the valuer so quick? They just, you know, screamed through my property. They came in, they came out. And how did they even get a sense of what the property's worth if they were in there for 5 minutes? Because it's not with an emotional attachment. We walk in, and I've said this before as well, it's like a duck above water or an iceberg, I guess. You just see the tip, which is the value walking around, but beneath the surface, there's a lot of analytical, assessing going on. And once we know what your property is worth, we compare it to the open market, what's been sold. We've got those two sales that I just mentioned, the really low one and the high one, and we've got to work out, was that one that was high for a reason? Was there, was that above market parameters, or was the one that sold cheaply, was that below market parameters? And that's where our expertise comes in to assess. Now, a homeowner could say, you undervalued my home because that home up the road sold for such a huge amount, but we saw that as an above market sale and we've had to pull that back and in turn pull your value back. Because that home
must be very hard in today's very hot market, though, Belinda.
Yes.
Where prices are going up as fast as we've seen in a number of decades.
It is tricky because week on week the market changes. Month by month, we're seeing, you know, percentages in the double digits sometimes. So it's, you know, you have a house valued today, and you may have the last 3 months of comparable sales evidence. And that gives you a smorgasbord of valuation, you know, figures that you could put on the property. You could, you know, if it's $1 million, you could go as low as 900 or 1.1. Because you got to understand, a bank valuer is valuing that asset for the bank to lend on. And they have to be pretty sure come that, this is the way we look at it. And I don't know if I've ever explained it like this. When we value your home, we assume, A, it's vacant, so it's no furniture. So no matter how pretty you make it look, means of no consequence to us. But the home is vacant and it's literally going to go for auction that day because the valuation is based on today's date, for instance, and it's assuming it will sell today and go to auction today in the open market. What would it get in its current condition, current market condition, current, you know, property condition, what would it get if it went to auction this afternoon? And we do our best to work that out for the bank because they are lending as at today's date. Tomorrow, anything can happen. We've seen what's happened the last couple of months. But today, what will it get? And that's our job.
So I know that in the more detailed valuations, the valuers also look at the risks. What sort of risks are you looking at? Because I think most people who see a valuation look at the figure. They don't often see the couple of pages behind where you actually look at various potential risks for your client. And your client actually is the bank or the lender in many cases. Look, it could be for other reasons, for divorce or for commercial reasons. But I think in general, we're talking about bank valuations here, Belinda.
Correct. Just quickly, when we are doing it for a capital gains valuation or a divorce, yes, it's an evaluation, but we I guess assess risks slightly differently. For the bank, an investor might see a risk as, are we going to get good rent long term? Is this going to be a good return on our investment? For a bank valuation, risk assessment could be as simple as being located opposite a school drop-off zone. It could be you may not be in a bushfire zone, but recent history with our bushfires that just happened, near enough is sometimes just as bad as in a bushfire zone. As we've seen, bushfires have jumped containment lines and they burnt homes that weren't necessarily in a bushfire zone. So we can even assess that as a risk.
Climate risk is a risk a lot of people don't think about, isn't it? Especially in far north Queensland, there are some areas that either are uninsurable or are becoming uninsurable. That's a risk people don't think much of.
No, even homes, waterfront homes, beachfront homes especially, tidal waterfronts, all sorts of the risk assessment on that has a whole half page sort of, anybody that's seen a valuation will see at the front page, there's a whole bunch of numbers and it reads like a 2422, all sorts of different things, even something on a title, an easement, an encumbrance on a title, a caveat, a covenant. We don't necessarily look into them at depth, but we let the bank know that this may have an adverse effect because we base our valuation on a fee simple vacant possession, meaning you own the property unencumbered completely without, you know, the effect of any sort of caveats, covenants, anything of that nature on your complete clean title. That's what we base our valuation on. Should this not be the case, it's on the bank. They, again, if we do get a copy of the title, from time to time they give it to us and we see that there's an easement, risk straight away. So
now I'm going to ask you some tips about good valuations in a moment, but what was the most unusual property you've ever valued, Belinda?
I have valued all types of property. I think the most unusual ones aren't necessarily unusual in the actual dwelling. It's more a hoarder home. I've gone into several homes with hoarders, yes. And it's unusual because of what they decide to keep in their home. That obviously means a lot to them that they've decided to keep 30 years worth of old magazines or Coke bottles. And
I've seen those.
Yeah, you go through those. We have an undisclosed policy at work that if you don't feel safe or if you feel that you're, you know, in any way in danger, you may leave the valuation, no questions asked. And I think I've only done that a couple times and it was just hoarder homes. They freak me out a little bit because you just don't know you don't actually know the condition of the property. What happens once you remove everything in that home? What's beneath all that junk, I guess, but...
Yeah, you've got to be able to see behind all that. And we've bought a couple of those over the years. There's often some surprises. I know you're very much into renovation. You've recently built your own home and you've covered that in your Instagram and your TikTok. But people are often thinking now, this is a stage of upgrading. The interest rates are cheap. Maybe it's hard to move today. So I'm going to improve my home. What adds value to a property? And what doesn't? Now, if you're doing it for your own home, that's not the only criteria, of course. It's important what you want to live, how you want to live, how you want your family and kids to live. But if we're talking numbers and figures, for example, does a swimming pool add value?
I will put it this way. Let's say, Michael, you spent $50,000 on a swimming pool. If it added $30,000 to your home, but you spend $50,000, I would say, yes, it added $30,000 to your property. Did you get a return on your money? No. Did you add value over and on top of what you spent to it? No. But did you add value to your home from the start cost base? Yes, you did. The key is whatever you renovate or add to your property, you'd like to get a return of at least a dollar spent to, you know, $1.20 to $2 on your money as a minimum. The key is, I guess, with a home when you are renovating, getting the obvious ones, Michael, are the kitchen and the bathroom. Get them right. I was thinking about this question and it's needs and wants. Everybody needs a kitchen, but some people want, you know, a big fancy kitchen with expensive stone. If you had cheaper stone benchtops or the ultra expensive one, would you get the exact same value on your property or are you overcapitalizing? And they're the type of questions you need to ask yourself to make sure that every dollar you spent, you're adding two back. Because if you're adding that extra $1.50 on your bench, but you're only getting $1.30 back, perhaps the cheaper stone would have been a better option.
I guess it also depends upon the location, doesn't it?
Correct.
In the more high-end suburbs,
correct,
you can add more and people are prepared to pay more. But in certain suburbs, there's just a ceiling. Adding more doesn't add value to the property.
Yes. And I think, you know, what's a lot to blame for that? And I think it's me, you know, being on that platform of Instagram is – Instagram has really influenced what people's perception of what they think they need. An example is everybody needs a laundry, but people want a big laundry, expensive looking laundry. That's a really easy place to overcapitalize because you don't really need all that expensive cabinetry and benchtop. Yes, it's a beautiful to look at and it photographs well for your Instagram page, but it's not something that, you know, is needed. Again, they find inspiration in these ultra expensive high-end homes and they've just got a home in the suburbs that they're building and renovating. They're very, it's not apples and apples.
So people can overcapitalize.
Yes, I think so. I think if you, it's hard because a more high-end home will always get top. It's like that saying I said earlier, Michael, with you don't want to be the best house in the worst neighborhood because you'll still get the top price. You'll still break records, but you won't perhaps have got as much if you were the not so good home, but in the best neighborhood. Then you can really see some great, your margin for making money is a lot more.
I guess an example would be if you've got a Hyundai car, nothing wrong with Hyundais, but you put the most expensive Bose sound system in, people are only going to pay that much if you go to the car yard and buy a Hyundai. But if you actually put the expensive sound system in a Mercedes or BMW, people pay more for the, or Porsche, they pay more for those extras. A different question I'd like to ask you is about aspect and orientation. People talk about northern orientation, getting the right sun, it's darker facing south. Does that make a difference? And it doesn't make a difference in different states, Belinda.
It does. Generally, north aspect is key. North aspect is the one that everybody wants. And I have seen northeast on an apartment, if you're buying in an apartment, is the gold, is the ticket. It just means that I've lived, my first unit that I bought was south facing and I did not think anything of it until I didn't have any sun for literally 4 months of the year because that sun didn't quite come around the building to get sunlight in my house. And when it finally did, I thought, wow, I'm never going to get a south-facing home. So I think until you've actually lived in that south-facing home, you don't know what it is to have that natural sunlight. The first thing I looked for when I bought my block that I built my house on was some sort of northern aspect. And that was a deal breaker, if you will. If you have a south-facing home and you're hearing this and you think, oh God, it's a wish, it's was north facing, it's not, I bought a dud, you know, incorporating some skylights, incorporating some larger windows. There's so many tricks now, I guess you can use, or renovating, you know, you can have an angled roof and have lights that capture that sunlight. So it's not the end of the world, but as a rule of thumb, we do pay a little bit more weight on those homes that are north facing because it's west, unfortunately, especially in those northern, you know, states of Australia, you get that westerly sun in the afternoon and you're barbecuing. And I'm not talking about the meat on the grill. It's,
no,
it's your family and friends.
Okay, what about main roads? People are saying, I can't afford this suburb. The price has gone up too much. So I'll get a secondary location, a main road or a secondary main road. What do valuers think of those?
We don't like them. We risk rate them actually, Michael. That is considered a risk rating. And we have different levels. We have sort of a minor and major when we talk about these. A minor would be a thoroughfare. So if this is a, you know, school drop-offs Monday to Friday, just, you know, work traffic, and then your Saturday and Sundays are relatively quiet, that may have a minor risk rating associated. Your highways and things like that are major. Because right now the market's up, real lack of stock at the moment. And you think to yourself, gee, I can't find anything. This is on a main road, but it's cheap, but it's a suburb that I want. I'm just going to get in. I don't care. I'll buy it. That's well and good. But if the market turns, they are the first ones to get hit the hardest. And they are the first ones that people look at and go, yeah, nah, not for me.
Not just owner-occupiers, tenants as well.
Correct.
Hard to get tenants on those.
They are. And if we see the opposite of too much stock and not enough buyers, if we have one of those markets, they sit there for months and they get heavily discounted, more so than, you know, just a relatively quiet residential street. So yeah, as much as that the best house in the worst neighborhood scenario, and if you've got the best house but it's the worst street and that street happens to be a highway, maybe you want to think again. Maybe find another worse street.
Now, regular listeners to this podcast or readers of my blog would know I'm not a fan of off-the-plan properties. I'm not a fan of house and land packages in the outer suburbs. What are your views on those?
I would say most people's greatest fear when they get a valuation is they cross their fingers and cross their toes. I hope my valuation doesn't come less than what I actually paid for the property. It's that anticipation. I would say that 95% of the actual valuations I have knocked back are off the plan. 5% are just, very rarely do I knock back a contract unless obvious reasons.
What do you mean by knock back, please,
Belinda? Knock back would be I get a valuation, I get a contract at say $1 million for an off the plan unit. I do my assessment, compare it with not just unit sales in the complex. It comes back at 900. I've now knocked back that contract. That's a very real thing for off the plan sales. I'll explain really easily, I think, so people understand. When you purchase and you sign a contract today, that off-the-plan purchase unit or house and land package won't be ready for another, let's say, 12 months. If in 12 months that market, there's a correction and we come back, I don't base my valuation at the contract date. I base it at the date that it's ready and I can physically walk through. And what that means is if it's come back 15 and 20%, then that valuation will reflect that. We find too that there is sometimes a premium paid of up to 5% of buying a brand new unit off the plan, a little bit like a brand new car. You drive a car out of the dealership and you just automatically lost 5%, 10%. Same concept with an off the plan unit. It's that emotion. I'm the first owner. Maybe it's a little bit up, but, you know, I get to pick all my color schemes. Yeah.
Belinda, it's also that there isn't as much of a secondary market because for investors, they get the initial depreciation allowances. For owner-occupiers, they get to choose the appliances, like you said. But for a secondary purchaser, when it's an established property, investors won't be attracted to it. They won't get the allowances. And the home buyers, well, it's not that brand new property where nobody's lived in it before. So do you take into account that the saleability, I guess is a better word, of those new and off-the-plan properties?
Michael, that's an excellent question that I don't think a lot of people consider because we do, we definitely do. And we have a very lengthy clause in our valuation that addresses that exact topic that you mentioned about it not being just as saleable as a secondhand product. Another problem we see as well, and we put it in our contract, in our valuation rather, is these units off the block are usually done in succession of many other unit blocks. And once they maybe enter the market, you find that you could have a real surplus. And I think you guys in Melbourne had that problem down. Was it South Bank? It was acquired.
Yeah, South Bank, Docklands, very much so. One tower after the other.
And we've got that here. And another thing that's been popping up in Sydney, and I don't know much about what's happening in Melbourne, is defects. There are some buildings and it's confidential. We have a list of them that we do with for the bank. The bank won't touch them. So unfortunately, if you are buying or refinancing in some of these buildings with known defect issues and they may only be 6 months old, the bank will not touch them. It's very, very hard to find lenders. So you may find an off-the-plan property. In 6 month time, there might be a defect and all of a sudden your asset is, I'm not going to say worthless, but very, very difficult to sell and refinance from.
Well, that's why we've never recommended new or off the plan properties. Now, to be fair, they shouldn't all be tarred with the same brush because there are some smaller boutique family-friendly complexes that are very, very good. But I think you and I are both talking about those Legoland high-rise towers that were in the past built specifically for investors with floor plans that weren't really usable and probably wouldn't have even been accepted overseas. So we shouldn't tar them all with the same brush, but I agree in general, one should be very, very cautious. Belinda, we've spoken a bit and there's so many more questions I want to ask you. So is it okay if you come back again and we do this again in the next little while?
Yes, of course. There's a lot I'd like to talk about too as well.
Well, I got all the stuff from you about renovations I wanted to talk about and your experience in that, because I think a lot of people want to do that. And interestingly, we can now probably let out a little secret, because by the time this show is going to be released, you and I are going to be speaking a lot more, because you've using now your many years' experience as a valuer, as a depreciation expert, as a property investor, as a homeowner and renovator, and you're now going to, or have now, joined our team at Metropol as one of our property strategists. And while you're based in Sydney, you're going to be helping clients nationally. And that's the depth of experience that attracted me to tap you on the shoulder and say, our clients need somebody like you who has got that experience of what works, what doesn't, what gives capital growth, what where you shouldn't spend your money. So it's going to be really fun having you as part of our team, Belinda.
Yes, Michael, thank you. I'm very, very excited to get started, actually. So it's going to be a little bit different to valuing for the bank, I think, but I worked out, I think it's about $10 billion of property I've valued over my career.
Gee, well, that's pretty good experience.
Yep, I've physically walked through 15,000 homes, been inside 15,000. I did the numbers. It's a lot. It's a lot.
That is. And so that's the depth of experience you can get if you choose to take advantage of our team at Metropol to help you on your journey. Go to metropol.com.au and find out about our range of services. And by the way, we have no properties for sale, but what happens when you speak to our team is you're going to start off by explaining where you are, where you want to get to, and then if you want to move ahead, what we'll do is put a strategic plan together for you, and Belinda will be using her experience and the experience of our team to actually put a strategic plan together, and then you can implement it using our buyer's agency services, renovations, property management, development, wealth advisory, even business advisory for the right people. So, Belinda, thank you so much for your time today. And if people want to get in touch with you, you're on TikTok and Instagram, and I'll leave a link in the show notes, as well as the link to metropol.com.au. Catch up again real soon.
Appreciate it, Michael. Thank you.
I hope you've got some benefit from my chat with Belinda, and as you can see, she's very different from what most people would consider a valuer, and with a vast knowledge, I'm really pleased that she's now joining Metropol as one of our property strategy teams, and together with me, Kate Forbes, and our research department will help our clients grow, protect and pass on their wealth. But there's lots of information she's got about renovations. That's one of her expertise in TikTok and Instagram. She spends lots of time talking about that, so I'll have to get her back about that as well. One of the lessons I think you should learn from all this is that there's never a perfect property. You're not going to find a perfect property, so the valuer will always find some things that are not exactly right. We've always got to make some sort of compromises. It may be compromise on how much you can spend. Don't compromise on the location, but you may have to compromise on the property, because even experienced investors have to make some compromise. But if you've got a good team around you and you do your due diligence, you'll have most of your bases covered. Just like there's never a perfect property, there's never a perfect time to invest either. So you've heard me say it before, my advice is not to try and time the market. Of course it would have been great to get into the market a year ago when I told you on this podcast it was the bottom of the cycle and time to pick up, but it wasn't right for everybody to do that. So the right time to get into the property is when it suits your financial circumstances and your needs. And with the market moving in front of our eyes, I think it's a great time to get your personal ducks in a row, get your finance in a row, your debt and your savings under control, get yourself into position to buy when you're ready and on your terms. So rather than saying, oh, it's too late in this cycle, or maybe I'll wait for things to happen, we know how many unknowns there are and how things keep creeping in. So set yourself up for smart property investment decisions. And if you're not sure how to do that or where to look or what to ask, why not get my team at Metropole to help you? Go to metropole.com.au and organise a chat with one of our property strategists where we can work out where you are, where you want to go, and help you by putting a strategic property plan together. That's very, very different from looking for the next hotspot. As an investor, you need to focus on the type of property and location that's always worked, not what's working right now or what you think is going to work in the short term. With all the mixed messages in the media, don't make 30-year investment decisions based on the last 30 minutes of news. Instead, take a long-term perspective. While the average Australian thinks about what's happening this weekend and the average investor thinks about what's going to happen in the next 2 or 3 years, successful investors, very successful investors, have a 20, 30-year horizon. And if you're not in it for 10 years, if that's not your plan, then you shouldn't be buying property at all. But you've also got to have a plan to get there. And again, that's where our team at Metropole can help you initially with a plan. And then our buyer's agency service can help you if you wish to buy that investment-grade property. Go to metropole.com.au and I'd love to be part of your ongoing wealth creation journey.
Now here's Michael's mindset message. Remember, a change in your thinking will lead to a change in your life.
In my mindset message today, I'd like to discuss with you 6 destructive habits that could be holding you back. Now, you probably know by now I'm a fan of habits. I've written a book. It's actually a bestseller with Tom Corley, Rich Habits, Poor Habits, and it's been translated into quite a number of languages, and now even Russian. The Russians have picked it up. That'll be interesting. So Chinese, Polish, Russian, Vietnamese, Malaysian, Indian, English, of course. So that's a great book, Rich Habits, Poor Habits, if you're interested in learning. But let me teach you something a bit different today, and it's not really about money habits. But when you talk about habits, there are good ones, and of course, habits that are not so productive. Some are bad habits. They're not good for us. They stop us from succeeding, and they reinforce negative patterns that we've picked up from our parents, our friends, our colleagues. Now, let's be blunt, no one's perfect, but I've found that most successful people find ways to replace their bad habits with good ones. Success in life, after all, is really just a series of good habits put into action over and over again. But in order to eliminate your bad habits, your poor habits, and form productive habits, we need to identify the destructive ones. So I want to give you a little checklist of 6 of the all-time bad habits. And as I go through these, see if any of these are relevant to you and what you can get rid of. Now, the first one I want to discuss with you today is thinking that the world owes you a favour. I can't tell you how often I come across this. A lot of people are quick to blame others when things go wrong, and they fail to take responsibility for the role they must have played as part of the situation. Of course, sometimes people do have a run of bad luck or are treated badly, but that's different from playing the victim all the time. Think about people in your own personal social circle, your friends, your family. I'm sure there's at least one person there you can think of who always blames others for their bad fortune. Tiring, isn't it? And they never actually get to the next level, do they? Fact is, there's no rich or successful victims. So the world doesn't owe you a favour. It was here before you were there. You're the pilot of your life. You're responsible for what's going on. Now, another bad, a destructive habit I'd like you to consider, see if you've got or somebody you know has got, and that's giving up too easily. Of course, setbacks will happen. They happen to everyone. Boy, have I had my share of failures and setbacks. Look, it's easy to look at other people's successes and think they got an easy ride. Most of the time they didn't. They just didn't let the setback stop them. So depending upon how you were raised by your parents, you're either going to take the setbacks in your stride or you're going to let them crush you. If you fall into the latter camp, then it's time to try and change this poor habit. Catch yourself every time you feel defeated and when something doesn't go your way and change your way of thinking. Don't give up at the first hurdle. So giving up too easily is a bad habit you should avoid. But there's also the opposite, not giving up when it's time, because a small number of people have got this opposite problem of not giving up too easily. It's the opposite. They don't know when to give up. They pour endless amounts of time, money, emotion into a project despite endless rejections and knockbacks. rather than trying a different approach, they continue to butt their heads against the wall and they're not getting anywhere. This kind of blind pursuit, that's not resilience. It's, I guess, what I'd call stupidity. As important as it is to chase your dreams, it's equally important to know when to stop, when to take a breath, when to try something else. Another bad habit that you should ditch is not being curious. If you think you know it all, if you think you've got nothing left to learn, you're not going to get to the next level. In fact, it's foolish, isn't it? This kind of self-belief, it stops you from growing. It short-circuits your imagination. It stops you from developing new ideas. So I believe you should aim to be one of those people who always ask questions, and don't be surprised if some of the answers are ones that you don't agree with. Don't get stuck in your own head or in your own career. Don't get so stuck that you forget that other people are also leading interesting lives, and they may well have a role to play in yours moving forward as well. So always be on the lookout to learn more. Now, I know in some ways I'm preaching to the converted because you're already making an effort by listening to my podcast, by reading my blogs. It's good for you. It's good for your soul. The next bad habit that I suggest, if you've got it, you should ditch, is not looking after your health. I mean, a minute ago I was speaking about your soul. It's important to ditch unhealthy lifestyle habits. I guess that means no burning the candle at both ends. Of course you're busy. Everyone's busy at the moment. You've probably been busier than you ever have been. But you've got to find time to look after yourself, to find some time to exercise, find a regime that suits you, that you can stick to. Eat well, try and get lots of sleep. Sleep's really important. And maintain a decent level of fitness. Looking after your body will help ensure that you're in good shape when life throws those inevitable curveballs at you and that you're fit enough to look after them. And the last of the six habits I'm going to suggest that you should look out for, the destructive habits that could be holding you back from the success you're looking for, is not looking after your finances. I mean, that's one of the reasons that I talk about money and finance in this podcast, because it's important to be financially fluent. Now, if you've got bad debts or you've got some credit cards that are not serving you, then work out how to get rid of those. The ability to look after your finances is one of the best predictors of long-term success. And I'm not just talking about money success or property investment success. If you learn money management skills, stick to a budget, save, understand the concept of delayed gratification, it shows that you've got this kind of self-control and maturity that's needed to be successful in other areas of your life and to see things through. Now, many of us have got one or more of these habits that I just mentioned, ones you need to work on. But you're also probably successful at some of these. I'm not suggesting that you've got all of these. Don't be complacent. Bad habits hold you back. They stop you from reaching your goals. And for some people, they can keep you poor, tired, and unhappy. So that's a good reason to ditch these bad habits and replace them with some good new ones. I hope you learned something from my chat with Belinda today and my discussion about bad habits. And if you did, why not tell somebody else who'd also benefit learning from this information? Please help me in my quest to make as many people as financially fluent as possible. There's a share button on every podcast app, or just tell them about the Michael Yardney podcast. Of course, you can tell the world by leaving us a review. I really, really appreciate those reviews. I'll be back again real soon, but in the meantime, you can catch me on social media. Just look for Michael Yardney. Why not join my private Facebook group, where every day I leave a snippet of information that you won't get elsewhere? Just look for the Property Update private Facebook group on Facebook, of course. I'll be back again real soon. In the meantime, have a great week. Make it a great week.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Michael Yardney podcast, which was brought to you by Metropole, who help their clients grow, protect, and pass on their wealth through strategic property and wealth advice. If you like what you heard and don't already subscribe, you'll find us on iTunes or on your favorite Android app as the Michael Yardney podcast. Watch out for our next show, which comes to you twice a week, and you'll learn some new ideas about property investment, success, and money in around 30 minutes. To get more of Michael's thoughts, go across to www.propertyupdate.com.au and sign up for his daily morning briefing, and you'll hear from not only Michael, but a group of leading property success and money experts. And just a reminder that the information you heard in this show today is general educational advice and not specific investment advice, as we don't know your personal circumstances. If you're looking for specific advice, why not ask the team at Metropole to help you?